I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar
mitzvah. Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
Well then, we'll welcome our listeners into episode 77.
Wow. It's a magic number.
Magic number. And so welcome to our podcast where you'll find theology, cigars, whiskey, and F-bombs. And if you hadn't noticed
it, bombs.
That's our t-shirt.
That's our t-shirt for Wild Gooses here. So our podcast is available on Stitcher, Theology Corner, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever you subscribe.
Right. So I realized something in doing the uploads for our last episode.
And what's that?
Yeah, that 75 never got actually loaded as a podcast. But so everybody that said they liked that podcast, they never heard it.
I guess that's why they liked it.
So it's loaded now. So for all our comments about Bibles Against Humanity, you can now listen to us.
Right.
Just delve into more sacrilege than to date we had.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you had noticed, if you hear a strange voice, we have a very, very special guest, one of our favorite people in the whole world. It's October, so it must be our Halloween visit from Uncle Phil, the incredible Welsh troubadour himself, Phil freaking Wyman.
I'm glad you said freaking, because otherwise, you know, I got to say it.
I know. I was for you.
What every little podcaster wants to grow up to be.
Absolutely.
If I fill in the... a favorite category, there's something really twisted about you guys.
Yeah.
You could have got that from episode one.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, we're not arguing with that. So. That's why I guess Twisted Sisters likes us too.
I'm on Twisted Sisters a good list this week.
Yeah.
Future podcast in the making, the retraction of I Kiss Dating Goodbye. I love how people consider that a theological work, because if that's what you consider a theological work, you should keep reading. It's a Joshua Harris. Anyway, I remember that came out, and I had people texting me going, well, you know, he was only 20 when he wrote that. Well, I was 19 when I barred it off one of the girls in my dorm, and I was like, this is shit. This is utter shit. I mean, you would have to, like, improve to get to shit level.
Right.
And pastorally... Yeah.
And at NC State, utter shit, has so many other meanings.
At an engineering school, if you can read a book, especially one labeled theology, and God, I'm using that with scare quotes, and you can understand it shit, then that's some shit.
Yeah. Well, since we have a very bearded podcast crew tonight, let's...
Oh, Becky's going to be on?
That was quick.
You had to go there, huh? Yeah.
So, she men knows. Of the beard oil, that
Pastor Nar, our favorite
Christian shaman,
one
Virgil of Cain whiskey, which I'm enjoying the rye right now, and I got a text from them. They're sending us a bottle of their new double barrel bourbon.
How much of that have you had already?
I just started on the rye, but double barrel bourbon is not that easy to say. So. But they're sending us one, so we'll test that out.
And I need to get hold of the Rip Track and the Electric Owl. We haven't had that.
But no, this is their new one, so they're sending that.
We're not bitching. No, we're not bitching.
No, not going to complain. Not going to complain. We're also sponsored by the Pipe and Pint.
Is that the one on Spring Garden?
In Greensboro, Spring Garden Road. Yes, it is.
Right.
As a matter of fact. And then Four Saints Brewing Company in Ashboro. And we'll be there on the 13th of November for drinking.
Well, you'll be there before then.
We'll be there before then drinking.
Let's get it up. I mean, it's
but we'll be there on the 13th to drink religiously.
Before that, they'll be singing religiously, though.
Yeah, Beer and Hymns is on the the fourth,
the first Sunday of the month.
First Sunday of the month, right? With our good friend Kristen Lee Mitchell. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, our other sponsor.
Cigar Lounge of Winston-Salem.
Yeah, and thanks to them, I'm smoking, because we're going to get right into what we're smoking. I'm smoking the NBK by Blockwork Studio. They had a blending event this week. Got to meet James Brown, hardest working man in cigar business.
Right.
And got to taste the leaves that go into this blend.
And it came in a casket I saw from
pictures. Yes, yes. That was Bethany, because
did Stacy just sit there and go ooh and ah for like 20 minutes just with the damn box?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, she did. So the MBK, it's an Ecuadorian Habano Oscuro wrapper, which you know is one of my favorites. Nicaraguan binder. The filler is Nicaraguan. It's Seiko, Veto, and Lajero. And we got to taste each of those separately and then got it together. So I'm smoking the whole cigar now. Chocolate on the pre-light, and that's what hits you first. Also that earthiness that we like. And just enough spice. The spice starts to build, though, and then you also pick up some nutty flavor in it as well. Box press, well constructed, a lot of smoke, really great cigar. So I'm enjoying
that. What's the specs on it, the like ring gauge and the total?
It's a Robusto, so okay. It's about 6.5 and about 52 or 50 box press. Most of their line that I like is in that range, although I did have the Insidious in a Lancero.
Yeah, you had that Saturday while I watched my school get trashed by
right. Clemson.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And it,
only to follow up the next day and have the fucking Patriots beat my Bears.
Hey, didn't go to we're happy about that.
We are.
Up here in New England, yeah.
It's a different story in 85. You got the first game of the World Series going the New England way.
Dang. We're ripping up here, aren't we?
Yeah. Sports capital of the world this month.
Yeah.
So what is well, how does it compare to the other black label that I've had? Because we've had several.
It's not as bold as some of their other ones, and that's mainly because it's not as much Lajero, and it's an Oscuro wrapper, Habano Oscuro. They also do a lot of darker wrappers. So it doesn't just come right out and announce itself like their other ones do.
So this could be the first and then followed by another.
Oh, absolutely.
From their line. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. You don't start with the morphine. But as much as you'd like to.
In my line of work, you do.
Well, yeah, it's true. And you end with the morphine in your line That's of right. work as well.
Well, it's yeah.
Yeah. So if you were smoking, I see you're inside, so I know you're not smoking, Chris. But
I got a review. I don't know if we've reviewed it or not, but it's the last one I smoked. Well, actually, no, it's not. I take that back. The last I had the 50 cal, the
right. boot camp.
And that was the second half of the fiasco in Clemson, and I can't remember the one I had before that. But it was the not the Wise Man by Foundry, but or Foundation. It was the the Habano, and I cannot remember which character it had on the label. Now it was really good, but the last one I smoked because we bought. Well, let me rephrase that. I was told we bought that same day a Chiminea. So now I can light fires in my garage, which is just, or a carport, you know, because you never know.
Because you're in Davie County.
Well, she wants to light a fire in the house tonight. And I'm just like,
well, at least let it get below 50 before you do that.
All right. So So I'm going to review really quickly because I don't want to know what Uncle Phil's smoking, but the tea. Which is one we've enjoyed. It is Frankenstein's monster as far as blenders go. You got AJ Fernandez, Matt Booth, Robert Caldwell. Caldwell's work I'm not as familiar with, but that's like Crowned Heads, I think, isn't it? His line? I forget.
I believe so. I'm not okay. sure, though.
We'll have our fact checkers check that.
Yeah.
As soon as we get some.
Want to get on that. We'll get our producer on that.
Well, they're going to be rather busy right now, you know. Pointing out how many ISIS members are, you know, escaping to the U.S. from Central America.
Coming through on the caravan.
Yeah, because, you know, Jesus, the Holy Family would have never, like, left an area because a government was trying to kill them. I mean, that's just so...
Really? Christian. Yeah.
There's just times I just really wish I could just be right beside some evangelicals and just look at them and go, seriously? You even fucking hear yourselves anymore? Motherfucker. So the teeth...
Yeah.
I got sidetracked there. Yes, it's a Robusto 5x5, 52 ring gauge. Ecuadorian Habana wrapper paired with Nicaraguan binder and filler. Mm-hmm. So you're getting it's just good Nicaraguan tobacco is what it is. Spice, chocolate, a little coffee, a little earth, a little leather. Super excited when I just saw the people going in on it. But the jury's still out, though, because really? I think I was expecting way more than, you know, that's it. All three of you guys got in on this? maybe AJ needs to drop the other two and go get Don Pepin and whichever Fuente's still alive and doing the thing.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. That's it.
So I'm not smoking right at the moment either because I have to be outside as well. But it's really cold out there, so I wasn't going to be smoking outside. So what I did was I finished just a little bit ago. I had something that's been around for quite some time, but I hadn't had it. It was the Carlos Taranio Reserva Selecta.
Oh, and,
yeah. Yeah. And this was a torpedo. So, you know, we're talking about Dominican, Honduran, Nicaraguan long leaf that have been aged for like 4 to 5 years. Mm. And then it has an Indonesian binder and an Ecuadorian Habano wrapper, which that's always nice, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not complaining.
I think so. Yeah. And as far as like construction and burn, this thing was absolutely perfect. So nice little razor edge going all the way down. And I smoked this thing to nothing was left. Now, there's kind of a flip side of this thing that, you know, there's, I guess, the good and the bad. So when I first lit this up, on the nose, it was just fantastic. It smelled like a field with the best of the soils possible. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. Mm. I lit it up. I was really disappointed. It was like arugula on leather with a turpentine dressing. It was like the worst of a bourbon whiskey. Like, you know, I thought, oh, if this stays like this, I'm not going to be able to smoke it. But before, as it got into that first third, that kind of all mellowed out, and it turned into this cedar with a slight sweetness that reminded me of maple. And then I was going, oh, yeah, I like this cigar. You know, at first I thought I had a dog rocket. Yeah. and then it just turned into something beautiful. And so, you know, throughout it was kind of cedar and leather with that slight mapley-like sweetness. And it was so good as it was going on. I just had to take a little nub that was left and stick it in the famous church warden pipe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good cigar then. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, so the church warden pipe, that's the one that it was your father's, Charles. And I tell people that story all the time, how, you know, I'm not really, haven't been a pipe smoker, and you suggested maybe you should get a church warden, and then it ended up in my hands as a gift from you. Mm-hmm. I honor that thing so much. Well, now when I get down to the end of a good cigar, it's also the thing that holds my cigar. Mm-hmm. And so this turned out to be a worthy little, it's a mild smoke. Mm-hmm. And it has a nearly creamy kind of smokiness to it. And, you know, it's that cedar leather, slight sweetness of maple. And, you know, at the beginning, it started out with a bit of white pepperiness to it, but that even mellowed out. It's just a mild, but really good cigar. Except for that beginning where I was going, oh my gosh, what is this?
Cigar grace, kids. That's what
yeah. Yeah. That's better than the opposite, though, where you're
turn for you burn.
You know, a cigar that starts out real nice and then, you know, there's a vein in there or something and all of a sudden it just turns really sour.
Right.
So that it's better when it starts out horrible but goes away and it's good. And you're probably drinking some really interesting beer, I'm sure. What do you have?
It's a simple Lagunitas something easy. It just went nicely with it. So yeah,
that's good stuff. It's good stuff.
And now for something completely different.
Four Saints Brewing Company. Four Saints pays homage to the patron saints of beer, St. Wenceslas, St. Nicholas, St. Luke, and St. Augustine of Hippo. They've become the most recognized patron saints for brewing and beer because of their contributions to and associations with the world's favorite sudsy beverage. Four Saints founders Joel McCloskey and Andrew Deming are carrying on the brewing tradition in hopes of future sainthood, or at least to make some really good beer. Four Saints Brewing Company, Asheboro, North Carolina. We have Phil on because we like talking with Phil, but we also have Phil on in October because he
lives. Someone else will talk to us.
Wow. Well, there's always that issue. But Phil is in Salem, Mass, for those of you who don't know. And Halloween is very...
The original Old Salem.
The original Old Salem.
We got ours in Winston, but I'm suspect.
Yeah. And
you guys are good for tobacco.
We're good for two cigarettes. Winston and Salem.
Right. Yeah, so Halloween is kind of important there. And it's played a pretty prominent role in Phil's life in recent years. We discussed a little bit about that when we were discussing your previous book, Burning Religions.
I have my copy, yes.
Yeah, which is wonderful. Y'all have to go get that, shameless plug. But you have a new book out called Reformation of Halloween.
Yeah, the Reformation of Halloween, indeed.
Yeah.
It's a terrible play on words, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's a wonderful play on words. So that's why we wanted to have you on to discuss that more and the whole confluence of the outreach that you've been doing with the neo-pagan community, the Christian community's reaction to that. Some has been positive, some has not been.
Let him tell the story, Charles.
I'm setting it up for him. I got to put it on the tee for him. You know, and how that is going. So... first, tell us a little bit about the genesis for the book, what your thinking was and what you're hoping to express with that.
So the book was kind of a last minute thought a few months ago. It dawned on me that among, quote, evangelical, whatever I am, you know, post-evangelical, evangelical-esque, I don't know, whatever I am kind of pastor, that I probably have more experience with Halloween than any pastor, at least Christians being involved with Halloween, than any pastor in history. because Halloween is not a day long in Salem.
Oh, no, I doubt it would be.
Yeah, it's 31 days long. It starts on October 1st, and the weekends are just mobbed here. And so we'll get anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people into our little city of 42,000 every October. And they're coming because of the neo-pagan influence, you know, our 13 or so witchcraft shops that are here, and all the witches that do their readings, palm readings and tarot readings and astrology and things like that. And then just the commercialization of Halloween. And I thought, why haven't I written something about this? I mean, it comes off the tip of my tongue so easily. So I powered this thing out because I have so many years of writing about it. And I'm convinced we just have this whole thing about Halloween wrong in most Christian churches. You know, we're afraid of something we shouldn't be afraid of. It's ridiculously afraid, right?
Well, and it's for me, I don't know, I've grown up in North Carolina my whole life, but I remember, you know, I grew up pretty standard, you know, Methodist, but our church had Halloween parties. They did a haunted house that using Sunday school rooms and part of the sanctuary when I was a kid. And then somewhere along the line, and I'm guessing Tipper Gore, Satanic Panic, and other shit like that, he just plain wimped out on Halloween, and it became this satanic, you know, it's no longer All Hallows Eve. We're not even going to claim that. It's, I don't know what happened, Phil. It just got hijacked.
Didn't it? Yeah. It and that hijacking is primarily found from the mid-70s through the 80s. And you're right about the satanic panic thing. I mean, first we had Mike Warnke somewhere around 73 mm-hmm. writing his Satan Cellar and tying witchcraft in with Satanism, you know, today's neo-pagan witchcraft with Satanism. And that was a whole made-up story. And he got busted by the guys, the Jesus people in Chicago. A couple guys followed his story and found out that he was indeed just telling stories.
Right.
And taking it around to churches, and they were all believing it. And then you had Michelle Remembers that came out in, I think, about 1980, and it was a psychologist and his patient who supposedly had experiences when she was young that were, you know, all of a sudden she remembered, you know, those memories that lie hidden, and all of a sudden you remember them in therapy.
like Sybil, you know, another great psychological truth.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, they both ended up leaving their spouses and getting married to each other. And that one got exposed as a fake story as well. So between those things, we were afraid of witches getting involved by cursing or somehow doing terrible things in churches. And then there was a fear that in daycare centers there was satanic ritual abuse going on.
And I was at that daycare, Charles, by the way. Mrs. Combs.
Yeah.
God rest her. Filthy old woman, so anyway, I'm sorry. Triggered.
Yeah, well there was memories, Phil. There was one in just south of L.A. in California, and then one in Boston as well. Right. And people were arrested, and supposedly, you know, the building that didn't even have a basement had a basement where children were being ritually abused. And
just like the basement of the Alamo.
Yeah, exactly. and so these stories entered into the urban myth of Christianity, and all of a sudden Halloween, All Hallows Eve, based upon All Saints Day and All Souls Day, which are November 1st and November 2nd, became this dark day where witches were doing really dark things. And of course, that was a natural fit because neo-paganism, which is really, neo-paganism is only as old as 50s. Wicca came to life in the 50s in the UK. With Charles, it was Alex Sanders and Gerald Gardner. And those were pretty much, that was the development of Wicca in the early 50s. And they had a cycle of holidays in the year, eight holy days that were based on solstices and the equinoxes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then 4 days in between that, and the, quote, holiest of those was Samhain, which you'll see spelled S-A-M-H-I-H-A-I-N. So people sometimes pronounce it Samhain, but it's a it's an Irish holiday in the old pagan Ireland. But along with this belief that Christianity pulled many of its rituals out of an ancient paganism. And that whole story comes from the transition from the 1800s to the 1900s and some bad anthropology that was making things up about these ancient pagans who were probably illiterate because we don't have any writings from them.
Right.
And then we have Caesar and his historians giving us two quotes, literally two quotes out of ancient history that the Welsh Druids, that's where it would have been in ancient Britain, that the Druids were sacrificing people. But of course, that was Caesar telling a story about why it was a good thing that they slaughtered an entire group of people. You know, the history is written by the victor kind of thing.
Right.
So we've taken that and attached it to modern Halloween, which the first time they found, they have any writings about somebody going door to door in North America is, I believe it's in it's in Toronto or Montreal. It's in Canada around 1910. That's so far away from ancient paganism that to connect the dots takes a lot of wild creativity. But we made that wild creativity. We connected those dots, and all of a sudden, Halloween was this terrible pagan thing. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous.
It is, and I don't put this in terms of, oh, this is evangelical Christianity. I go back to the particular Christianity that first came to this continent, and those were Puritans. Because right. If you look at Los Dias de Muertos in Hispanic culture,
right,
that is still celebrated as a remembrance of our ancestors and those who have passed. And, you know, it's no church rails against it. It's celebrated. People go and light candles in their churches for their family who've passed on. So,
like All Saints Day.
Yeah, it's a very similar kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, it's more of the fact that so much of American Christianity still, well, just so much of American culture in general still has that Puritan tinge to it.
Yes, a people too uptight for the English.
Exactly.
Or you the can Scots. Keep your Puritans will, Phil, I'll take our Moravians down here. They just make really good cookies and... That's where we're at.
Yeah. Well, not to also too uptight for the English, but for the Scots as well. It was James who was scared to death of them.
Right.
Get these he wanted a mountain. The whole reason they came here is he was plotting on tracking them down in the Netherlands. And and so Holland and everybody had to kick them out because James was threatening to invade. I mean, he wanted them wiped out.
I think I was excited Phil's going to be on anyway, but when I saw it, when you texted me the topic, I was like, oh. I knew it would be something Halloween-y, but I've been listening to a podcast, a good one, so it's not ours, Charles.
Oh, okay, good.
Unobscured by Aaron Mankey. He's the guy that does Lore and Cabinet of Curiosities, and his series, it's kind of like, he's doing like a serial, and mm-hmm. it's on the Salem Witch Trials, but he's going back and doing the historical, the proper historical work, and not just sort of just telling the story, mm-hmm. really digging back. What are the cultural? What are the economic? What are the religious? And I'm only in episode 4. That's all that's out. But that just strikes me that all the nonsense that's there during that time. Now you've got 31 days of Halloween. What a change!
Yeah.
Well, you know, 31 days of Halloween. I'm excited about it. I was excited in 1999 when I moved here. It was like, what a great day of the year. For Christianity, and we've missed the boat in America. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, there's a movement of Halloween growth that's happening in nations all around the world, and I think places like the UK and Ireland, Australia and Canada have, and churches probably have an opportunity to take this day and use it right, as opposed to get all freaked out about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, even the secularization
get past the nonsense.
The secularization of it. I mean, it's like it's little kids getting candy. Like I'm old enough to remember they put razor blades in apples. I'm like, who the fuck gives out apples? And then, you know, and of course, like the Satanic Panic.
All right.
Later, never happened. Pure fiction.
Right. Right.
But I remember my mother taking us to the hospital to have our candy bags X-rayed.
Right. Oh, man, I never had to go through that.
Yeah, no, growing up, it was like you get all these ads from the, you know, from all the hospitals and doctor's offices. Oh, bring your child's candy here.
We'll nuke
parents,
it.
Parents, don't forget to go through the candy. How to identify needle marks on the wrappers of the drugs that are being put into your child's Halloween candy. You know, anything we're afraid of, we just lump it into this holiday.
Yeah.
Right. And the most frightening thing for me growing up, and I mean this literally, was not like the razor blade shit. It was the neighbors up the street that gave those goddamn chick tracks out. Oh my God. You talk about like fucking somebody up. If I'd have swallowed a razor blade, I'm messed up for a couple weeks, maybe. Not like I think God's going to fuck me over, man. I'm like, shit. That's frightening.
Come on. Go Google that one.
I'm telling you, man.
Remember the This Is Your Life track? It was the most famous of the trick tracks.
I think Charles and I should write. I, you know what? Phil's the writer. Charles is an editor. We could. I mean, the anti-track. The track to respond to all bad tracks. I mean, it could be the serial that goes along with Phil's eventual graphic novel that he just has to do from his Welsh folk tale.
The Tales of Windy.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need to have tracks that torment people through life. They like grow legs and follow them around.
Also, when you're talking about you're in Salem, and that also I think has part of it is dealing with that part of our national history of the Salem witch trials is also part of it. Nathaniel Hawthorne spent a good deal of his life trying to repair his family's reputation.
Right.
Because his grandfather was one of the judges. He was horrified by that, by his family's connection to it.
Yeah.
A large part of the impetus for Young Goodman Brown was trying to put Satan in a little better light and a Christian who could encounter Satan and not become possessed and become a witch.
I got a cultural question when we get back to this. I have a cultural question.
Okay.
And I'll pose this, throw it out there. Did the Puritans and all the rubbish that went along with that, did it come south and create the Bible Belt and the nonsense we now don't associate with the Northeast, but the Deep South? Ooh, I don't know. That may be a stretch.
That may be a stretch. I think it's more the innate superstition of the settlers in Appalachia.
You think that?
Yeah. Yeah. And that.
I know why we're more religious society in the South. There's actually a very good book on that, and that escapes me, but it's probably staring me in the face. But the South was an event-based society because we lived so far apart because it was an agrarian society.
Right.
So church was a time everybody got together, so that's why it became such a big part of it. The irony is that you also got to put other type events like court hearings and, you know, slave auctions and lynchings and other things that people in the South, unfortunately, got together to do.
Right.
And religion in the old South, and I cannot...
And it's also a very, especially for the first settlers, a very rural, primitive area. And you're very, very separated from your neighbors and others. So there's lots of things to be fearful of. That's why I say that part of that is also just that superstition and fear of the unknown and what's in the dark forest, because you were living literally in the dark forest.
Well, is it just like when it's just that human trait that when we don't know, we're just afraid of it. We otherize it. We make it into, in this instance, a very real boogeyman, or at least in a fictional sense. I mean, we're still doing it. Arthur Miller
didn't have
much to do to come up with the Crucible and make it fit for the McCarthy era. Mm. And that's witch hunts, Red Scare still going on. Except now the Reds are screwing up our elections. And anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And now we're afraid of Muslims, and they're coming up from... Yeah. South America right now, right?
Yeah. Armed with small children and no belongings and crippling poverty, malnutrition, another weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that are happening in Salem? In terms of your outreach and some of the, you do some cool stuff during this month. So right. What are some of the things you've been doing?
Well, so I run a stage, an outdoor stage that goes on every weekend during the month. Obviously, there's one weekend left, which could end up with a big nor'easter on Saturday. That's what it looks like at the moment, that we're going to get slammed by rain and high winds, which will certainly squelch whatever we do.
Clearly God's judgment.
That's it. Coming down upon us. And then Wednesday night, Halloween will be big. So we've had or are having four different teams from different places around the U.S. Pappy and his gang from Cary, North Carolina, are here all month. Ran a house in Gloucester, and Pappy and Michael are running that, and a different crew comes in each week.
That's the DeSanka crowd, right?
That's the DeSanka crowd, awesome. Yeah. They are. They're amazing, huh? Mm-hmm. My favorite crew to work with. They're in the UK when I'm there as well. And then there was a group called Generation 333, which was brought some people who were studying at Global Outreach in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They just do a great job of loving people and praying for people. And they're always doing things like praying for the sick. And it's amazing. People stand in line sometimes for an hour, experience this. Of course, you know, when you're the only free gig in town, it's going to cost you $45 to sit for a few minutes and get your palms read or the tarot done. And then you can sit with people who are sitting in a tent and just going to love on you. People walk out of these experiences saying, wow, that was free, and I just paid a lot of money for something that was less. We experience a lot of that.
Wow.
And so the last weekend, and then on Halloween, we'll also be joined by a group from Maine called the Love Project. And typically they come into town as your kind of classic new wave Pentecostals that like to pray all night and worship all night, and then they come out on the streets and they just create a party. It's really amazing. And they just love on people and hug them up. We have hug lines going on and dream interpretation. And then they do crazy things like tattoo interpretation, which that amazes me. Tattoo interpretation. I mean, I don't have any tattoos because I just think to myself, I'd probably outlive my feelings about the tattoo. And then I'd look at it and go, what did I put that stupid thing on me for? Yeah. And if I did put something on it, I'd know why. But
you would hope that you would know why, yes.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people who look at that and say, tattoo interpretation. I want to check that out. Mm-hmm. I think there's something legitimate about being too close to something to actually see my reason for it. You know, it was Mikhail Bakhtin who said that other people know us better than we know ourselves. We have this myopic kind of thing that occurs. And somebody else sees the weirdness in me that I can't see. I think it's cool. They know it's weird. And then I think also there are some things that we think about ourselves as weird, but other people see as interesting. And perhaps tattoos can be like that. And so there are a number of people who've come through for tattoo interpretations that walk out saying, wow, that changed my life. And I, you know, 19 years later, I'm still scratching my head saying, wow, they're standing in line for this stuff that if I was to walk up to them on the street on during, you know, kind of their movement of everyday life with their workaday world and their concerns, they'd say, I don't have time for this. No. Get away from me. But when they go to Salem, people are clearly looking for something because this is a spiritual town. Mm-hmm. And it carries these dynamics of spirituality and expectation. And they step into it. And for too long, the church has run away from that kind of stuff.
Saying,
oh, it's demonic. Don't touch that. Meanwhile, we hide out in churches. And, you know, when I read the Bible, David says, the righteous are bold as a lion. And then Jesus tells us to be wise as serpents and as harmless or gentle as doves. And we act like we're bold when we stand in a room and scream at devils. Give me a break. Boldness is walk out there and talk to people and love them no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so we've just got some great groups that have been working with us for a number of years now. And over the course of the 31 days of Halloween, there'll be a couple hundred people who will have come in from Texas and North Carolina and Maine and Pennsylvania and California and the UK. My favorite UK vicar was here, the goth vicar from Glastonbury, Diana Ingalls Greenfield. She was just here this last week. Absolutely amazing. And she's doing the kind of stuff in the UK that we're doing here. So, all I can say is I've had the equivalent over almost 20 years of 600 Halloweens.
That's not a sure way
to look at it. It's 31 days of Halloween, right?
Yeah.
You know, Charles, that this is like the test case for, and I might have to quote our good friend Jay Dana, it's not about evangelism, it's about hospitality.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, two things. You'll be very proud of me. I was doing a presentation for some colleagues on student-centered teaching, and I quoted Bakhtin.
Oh, so. Okay. Yeah. I love you. I love you anyway.
Isn't that the stuff you put on wounds when you're a little kid, they spray it on you?
Yeah, but this doesn't hurt. This is love.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and as I'm writing it up, and I'm like, oh, Phil's going to love this.
Nice.
Yeah, threw in a little Levinas, some Paulo Freire.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But on getting back to the Halloween part, can you tell the story? This is still one of my favorite things you've ever done.
Right.
And that was the confessional.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I
don't know if we've recorded this. We've told.
Doesn't matter. It can be done again.
You've got it because this was so powerful and wonderful and simple.
Right.
And I think really can be, sort of like symbolic of what we're talking about with the church having to not run away from this. Tell us about that.
So this was 2006 when we first did it. And we were beating it around for a couple of years. My friend James Wilcox came up with the idea. He was reading the book Blue Like Jazz by Donald Miller. And there's a story about him at Reed College in wherever that is in Oregon. He set up a confessional booth. And it was a reverse confession. What happened was people came in expecting to confess their sins. And the person or people inside the booth who were dressed like monks with incense burning, looking all cool, said, well, we know that you expect to confess your sins, but what we want to do is confess the sins of the church to you. So we set one of those up. And as typical of any carnival kind of atmosphere, people start to get involved when you get a few people to go in, then everybody else says, oh, okay, that's safe, and maybe it's cool, because there's a line. And so I dressed up like a monk, and I had a big sign saying free confessions, and I went around with a couple other people chanting free confessions, being silly in a carnival kind of way. And eventually a few people went in. And then a friend of mine, Sean Poirier, he's no longer alive. He was one of the witches in town. And to many people, one of the most feared witches in town. He was a kind of a dark character with wild hair, and he actually looked like Rasputin. Legitimately, he looked like Rasputin, and he loved to be terrifying. That was part of his quote magic, to freak you out. And he very charismatic with a real smooth voice. So everything about it was wild and crazy. And he came up to me and he said, "What happens in that confessional booth?" And I said, "Well, I can't tell you. You got to go find out." And he tried to drag it out of my friend Jeff. Jeff said, "Well, I can't tell you. You got to check it out." He couldn't go in by himself, so he grabbed a couple of the other witches. He and a friend of mine, Christian Day, who, that's his name, Christian Day, and he's
good
a
name
witch.
For a witch.
He's a gay witch. It's his actual name. His mother's name is Mary. I mean,
you can't make this stuff up.
You can't. This is they. So Sean goes in with a couple of the witches from the psychic fair that he and Christian Day ran. And I come back about half an hour later, and he's standing outside. Sean's just a massive guy. He's just crying. And, of course, his makeup is running down his face. And the other witches who were with him, they're crying. They're sucking on their cigarettes. And I said, "So how did it go?" And his response was, "That was the most amazing thing I've experienced this Samhain."
Wow.
That was absolutely life-changing. Well, what he did was he went back to his psychic fair and he said to them, "You guys have to go into the confessional booth." And he did the same thing. He didn't tell them what it was like. And the number of witches who came out crying, just, I mean, they were falling apart. And pretty soon, the other witches from other shops in town, they were visiting because they were hearing the story about this confessional booth. And we went through something like 35 to 40 witches going through the confessional booth, coming out just crying because Christians were apologizing for the burning times and for treating witches as somehow subhuman or maybe as demonic. At one point, one of the psychics in the psychic fair was doing a reading for a person who came in and said to this lady, "You got to come with me. I'm going to take you somewhere, and this will change your life." The psychic brought somebody they were doing a reading for into the confessional booth to hear this. And the same thing happened. The person just said, "Oh, my gosh, I've been burned by churches where I was a leader. And ostracized by the church, and this is something I needed to hear."
Wow.
So over the years, we've done that confessional booth on and off, and you know, we've come to the conclusion that today one of the best apologetics for the church is an apology. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're telling that story, and the only thing I could think of, well, many things I could think of, but one was how much of a Pentecost movement it is. From behind closed doors, the Spirit breaks out, and it breaks out.
Yeah.
People of faith, Christians particularly, admit their own sinfulness, admit their own humanity, and approach others with humility and apology. And actually, our congregation here in Winston, they did that at Pride this year in Winston. They stole your idea, Phil, or they stole it from somebody.
They stole the idea from someone else.
But and it had, I want to understand, a similar just powerful response because it was just totally disarming.
Yeah. And I one of the reasons I wanted you to tell the story, besides the fact that it's a good story and it's about the power that those kinds of crossroads has, but it's also, I think, symbolic of what needs to happen if the church is going to come to terms with Halloween, with all these things we're talking about.
It's bigger than Halloween, Charles.
That has to start with a reckoning of your own history.
Right.
You know, you have to embrace it, acknowledge it, apologize for it before anything else could happen.
It's bigger. I mean, it's Crusades, it's Inquisition,
it's the
Third Reich, it's the...
Yeah, but this is on the small scale, is what I'm saying, you know, as example. No, there needs to be a good friend that I made at Wild Goose, because I tend to do that, as you know, Phil. Darren Weston.
Yeah.
We want to go on an apology tour because we were standing outside the tent for Beer and Hymns.
Oh, yeah.
Beer and Hymns that they do at Wild Goose, there's a, any song that has the blood of Christ in it, they sing. So not only were we saying, you know, this is just really bad theology, but as he's listening to it, he just kept turning to me and goes, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry for what we've done to you people. I'm so sorry for everything we've ever done to the Jews. Can you forget? I mean, he was just.
Well, and it's similar experience. You know, when they did go down Moses.
Well, yeah.
I was like,
And so then there's other things. So and he's African-American. And I turned to him and I said, well, I'm sorry. I apologize to you for everything that, you know, that has happened by white Americans. And so we've decided that there just needs to be this apology tour.
Yeah.
That we just, everybody just, you know, whatever group you belong to and whatever, or you identify with, whatever group that has been hurt by them, seek them out, apologize, and let's mend and heal. And in fact, we had an idea. We haven't done it yet. We want to do an hour podcast. And it's just him and I apologizing.
Oh,
yeah. I'm sorry. Well, no, I'm sorry.
You're sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, because
I'm more sorry than you.
No, I'm more sorry. Yeah, we don't want to get to that, but yeah. So yeah, there's more places absolutely that this needs to happen, but I think this shows that it works.
Amen.
Yeah,
it's that first step. It's the first step of tshuva. As okay, Chris, 50 minutes, Rambam.
Yeah, good job.
Okay, good job. You know, Rambam said that, you know, there's three steps to seeking forgiveness, to repentance, to tshuva, to returning to God. The first is acknowledging it and promising never to do it again.
Right.
And then the third step is to never do it again.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, we've got to start with the acknowledging and the apology.
Yeah. Mm. I think that's such a way that humanity blossoms, and it's sort of the antidote to future witch hunts, you know, and metaphorically, literally, is when you, because with the apology, it just diminishes, if not omits, your ability to otherize the other person. You know, well, the dehumanizing.
You have to, and it's 51 minutes, boober. you have to apologize fully and truthfully. You have to enter into an I thou. You have to see
right.
the other as human, and therefore capable of being hurt by you.
Right.
And that their forgiveness now becomes important to you as well. So not to get it transactional, but you know, you don't apologize to an animal that you hurt. You don't apologize to an inanimate object. And the big problem is when we don't see the other as human.
You know, Charles, I was thinking, right. I feel really convicted by what you're saying in a good way, is that we talk about how do we dial down the rhetoric between the left and the right.
So yeah.
What would it look like for me as a, for all the things I am, good, bad, and indifferent, to apologize in all those identities to other people? Mm-hmm. And I was particularly fixated on, Lord, sort of like the intellectual elite, the liberal, and what would it be like to apologize to those that I may have hurt? You know, and that's
right.
Racial identity, the faith identity, and male identity, and white Southern, you know. But it's really, wow, you've stumbled onto another podcast within a podcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a reason why we make this an annual process.
Right, because we don't have a dose of fill, we start sweating and heart palpitations.
Torment yourselves? Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fill withdrawal.
But the whole point of the days of awe, leading into Yom Kippur, where we ask forgiveness from God for all our sins, the preparation for that is some people extend it for the whole month of Elul, but certainly just the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, those 10 days are supposed to be spent going to everyone you know that you've hurt, you might have hurt, you have no idea if you hurt them or not, and just anybody that you can find that you come across and apologize and ask forgiveness.
Charles, you know what we're going
to do? It's an annual thing.
I got a wild goose thing for us.
Okay.
A reverse altar call.
Hmm.
I don't know what it looked like, but I just, we're taking the confessional. We're trying to package it for a North Carolina or predominantly Southern audience.
You're sounding like Peter Rollins now.
I loved his albums. But wrong Rollins.
Wrong Rollins.
Different one. That was Henry. That was his brother.
Yeah.
God, I'm going to have every Rollins song stuck in my head the rest of the night. I have no one to blame but myself.
All right. Well, let's bring this back to what Phil's doing, and let's bring it back to Christianity and paganism and witch hunts. I want to get your take. Again, you were one of the first people I thought of when this came out with the report that a group of witches, after the Kavanaugh confirmation, gathered in D.C. to cast curses on Congress. And that idea, but then also the Christian outrage over it.
Over that.
Not so over the Kavanaugh confirmation. There was no Christian outrage over that.
Yeah.
You know, that these witches, you know, first of all, my take was, and some other people saw this, so it's not that I'm really smart, but other smarter people have said it, that, you know, to be outraged by that, you have to actually believe that witches can do that.
Right.
So you can't say that, they're not real, this is nothing, and then be outraged that they're doing it.
Right. So from the perspective of witches doing it, I was just talking with a friend of mine who is an owner of a number of pagan or witchcraft stores, and he referenced that particular event, laughed about it, and said, "That's absolutely ridiculous." So to take that particular story of a group of witches getting together and cursing Kavanaugh and make it something that all of the neo-pagan community across the United States is doing, I knew it before he said that a number of them would think it was stupid, but you know, now I got it directly from their mouths. They were just looking at that like, it's just a gimmick, really.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't want to disbelieve in magic or miracles.
All religion is based on it, so.
Right. So can witches do things? I'm going to say, with a million caveats that I can't even get to, yes, but, you know, in the same way that I believe that prayer is effectual. Do I think there's dark and light elements of that which we would call magic or the miraculous? Yeah, I fall into that category. But you know what? I just don't get worried about it. It's not something I'm making a game of that somehow I have to counteract personally. And evangelicals in their position with Kavanaugh,
if anybody sold their souls.
The soul was sold at the vote for the president. That's my position. And all along the way, there are little steps. I'm not going to pretend to know everything about the past of everybody involved with that, but wow. The whole thing was just dark on every level. And I look at it to the right and to the left, it was dark on all sides. It's games we ought not to be playing, but we're playing them. And I don't want to be part of them.
Thank you. I knew we were going to get some perspective. And that's why, and that's why I thought of it, because I'm like, you're there, you're in Salem, you have friends in that community. And how they viewed it.
Because
that's what I was reading also, is that it was just, that was their form of protest. That was, rather than putting up a sign,
right,
how they voiced their displeasure with that decision.
Right. And religious people will voice their protest in ritual ways, right?
Right.
That's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's okay to do that.
So the book is The Reformation of Halloween. It's out now, right? It's available on Amazon.
It is. Available on Amazon. The title comes with all kinds of loaded material. Martin Luther, of course, Reformation Day, That is Halloween Day. He nailed the 95 thesis to the Wittenberg door on Halloween, right? And Martin Luther and I have these things in common. We have the same birthday, and our best-known work happened on Halloween.
You didn't come up with a new denomination on the toilet, did you? That's also one of Luther's. I love the tower experience.
I need to do that.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Everything will be complete. I'll have gone full circle.
And a nice BM.
I can make all sorts of bathroom humor jokes about that in our podcast, but
yeah. Our podcast is a BM. Let's just be honest.
It is. But there's one thing we have to do, Chris. I mean, I've gotten in Rambam and Buber, and you've said shit a few times, but fuck. You haven't dropped one F-bomb.
They're fucked.
Okay, oh, no. He got a few in.
He got a few in?
I did.
You heard it?
Yeah.
He
mentioned his mother on one of them.
I don't even pay attention anymore.
Just background noise.
Yeah, it's all background noise. So, and somewhere in there we put in a commercial.
Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey started with one goal, to create the best damn whiskey around. Drawing on their culinary know-how and driven by flavor, founders David and Ryan, both accomplished chefs, were inspired to boldly blend, infuse, and tinker with choice ingredients to craft category-shattering whiskeys, proving that it's not about stuffy tradition, but about taking what you know and taking chances. Each of their spirits is a tribute to their dedication to making whiskey their way, a whiskey they'd want to drink. Again, Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey, a damn fine whiskey.
So I was going to get to words of wisdom.
I wish you would.
So we could wrap this up. All right. So as always, these are random.
Totally.
So this is Joseph Conrad.
Oh, Heart of Darkness.
Yeah. He once wrote, "There is something haunting in the light of the moon. It is all the dispassionatelessness of a disembodied soul and something of its inconceivable mystery."
But wait, there's more.
Okay. Right. Can I throw one in?
Sure.
Of course.
Okay, this is from a book called The English Year by Steve Roud, who is a historian of folk history and magic in the UK. And so this is about the calendar of the English year. Mm-hmm. And this is what he has to say about Halloween. "Halloween is probably the most widely misunderstood and misrepresented day in the festival year. But so many now believe that it was originally a pagan festival of the dead that this belief is virtually impossible to shake. The facts, however, are very different and far more elusive and complex."
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Shoulda woulda coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.